Hey, Fight Fans, MMA odds maker Nick Kalikas here for BetOnFighting.com. If you're searching for the absolute best place to bet on all the latest fight odds and more, then look no further. BetOnFighting.com originates more lines than any other sportsbook, featuring a larger selection of betting options including props, totals, parlays, and live-in-progress fight wagering. It's easy to see why BetOnFighting.com is recognized as the industry leader in MMA action. Don't miss out on all the fun. Make sure you head on over to BetOnFighting and open up your account today. BetOnFighting.com, where the MMA line originates.
What's up? This is Gina Carano, and you're listening to MMA Weekly Radio.
Trying to get back to Stockton here. Fuck your mother!
Ladies and gentlemen, we are live with MMA Weekly Radio. Introducing first, broadcasting out of every corner. This man is the leader of the Nerdcore movement. He is none other than Damon Martin, his colleague, broadcasting out of the blue corner. He is an all-around good guy. He is known as Jeff K.
Rocky Ruckus. MMA Weekly, loud and live. Get your battle on, right along, and let's survive. News, rumors, and interviews, there's something to get into. All around, scope from the keys, from the giving you. Finding something more, I'm gonna talk the talk. Get it in the open, from the walk the walk. From the click of the mouth to the open, move in. Double like a superpower, I'm mutant, move in. Grabbing them, stripping them, punching them, kicking them, cutting them, ripping them, tackling them, ripping them, rocking them, finish them. MMA Weekly. You can agree and disagree and put the running of any topic that doesn't mention me. End of the world is coming on, saying who is he? Mike and Rogers are stepping it up like a submarine. Yeah, running the down with him in the jail. Like the original mutants in the real with the X. Sitting around with the cage all around the globe. If you didn't know, previous, well now you know. Come on!
Rapping them, tripping them, punching them, kicking them, cutting them, ripping them, tackling them, flipping them, rocking them, finishing them. Let me leave you MMA Weekly Radio!
And with that, we welcome you to the big show. I am Damon Martin, rolling alongside Jeff Kane, as always. And Jeff, it is our last show of the week, so we're going to go out in style. It is Thursday. We got lots of guests, lots of debate topics. What better way to kick into the weekend mode?
Yeah, I agree, man. Last show of the week, though. I can't say that I'm not happy about that.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. So we will see. But we got great guests today. We're going to be talking, actually, really cool interview today. First time we're having him on the show. He's a very famous former pro skateboarder, has done MMA as well, and he has a new book out as well. He is from XM Sirius Radio, one of the most popular shows in the nation. Jason Ellis is going to join us on the show today. We're also going to be joined by Invicta FC headliner and former Strikeforce women's champion Marlus Kunin, and we're also going to talk to one of the main card fighters from this next weekend's Maximum Fighting Championships card. Adam Lin is going to stop by the show. So a big show today. Lots of guests, lots of interesting guests, and of course, lots of debate topics. And I think we should just go ahead and get into that.
Yeah, let's just jump right in.
Well, we announced it last night. We broke the story on MMAweekly.com that Eric Koch will be the man that will face Jose Aldo next for the UFC featherweight title of the world at either UFC 147 or UFC 149, depending on how they decide to deal with his title shot. So here's the question. Eric Koch's getting the next shot. Do you like it, love it, or hate it?
I like it. We kind of figured that was going to be the case when Hauki just said, I'm not taking the fight. And Poirier said he's not ready for it, you know, and then Mendez has already lost to him. I mean, it kind of just falls on Eric Koch's lap in a way. So, I mean, I don't dislike it. It's just a huge opportunity for Eric. It is what it is. You know, we talked about pound-for-pound rankings the other day. I mean, here's a guy in Jose Aldo who gets overshadowed by Anderson Silva and John Jones, and rightfully so. But, I mean, you know, hell, he's run Uriah Faber out of the division. Here's a guy who's, there's plenty of people to fight. They just don't want to fight him. You know, so props to Eric Koch for stepping up. I mean, you know, that I like.
Here's what I'll say. I will say that I absolutely love this move. I love it for a couple of reasons. One, as you mentioned, plain and simple, Eric Koch said yes. And I love that. The guy said yes. The guy stepped up to the challenge and said, yeah, I want this fight. I want it right now, and give it to me. And our next debate topic, of course, is going to be about guys who have turned down the shot. But here's the thing. I think striking-wise, I think matchup-wise, Eric Koch's a very interesting matchup for Jose Aldo. This is a guy who has world-class kickboxing, huge knockout power in both hands, both feet, trains under Duke Rufus. He's a dynamic striker. You know, he's one of these guys that can slip under the radar because he hasn't had a big high-profile fight at 145 yet. But why not? I mean, this guy's willing to step up to the challenge. He's going to stand and trade with Jose Aldo. You know, he's going to go out there and give Aldo a freaking fight, and I love that about him. And I'm a big, big Eric Coke fan. He's got a great mindset. Obviously, he's not afraid to step up to the challenge. And my number one reason for this is he said yes. And I'm not saying that because he's the only one, because, listen, title fights don't come along very often. We're going to debate that for the next topic. But fact is, Eric said yes. He said, give me this shot. I want this title shot. And I love that demeanor. I love that moxie. I love that makeup. That's an intangible you cannot teach. You cannot teach balls, Jeff. You cannot teach time to step up. And Eric Coke showed that for this fight.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's sort of my feelings, too. Props to Eric Coke for stepping up and saying yes. Because, look, Jose Aldo is one of the most dominant fighters in the world right now. But like you said, this is a compelling, striking matchup if it stays standing. So I don't know that Eric was even on Aldo's radar, you know. So he might slip in here and shock the world in this fight. Yeah, I love it with you, man, but you know, Jose Aldo, man, he's the one nobody wants to fight right now in the sport, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, you step up to the challenge. You know what I mean? You step up to the challenge. And like I said, Eric Coke. And like I said, I mean, I love this fight. I mean, listen, there's a lot of other intriguing matchups. I mean, I think Dustin Poirier is an intriguing matchup. Obviously, mm-hmm. I think Hatsu Hayoki is an intriguing matchup. But at the end mm-hmm. of the day, I like the matchup with Eric Coke. I think he is a dangerous guy on his feet. He's got real, real knockout power. I mean, we saw him in his last fight against Jonathan Brookins. While it wasn't the most exciting fight, you know, he had a guy basically trying to take him down to the ground, which is his only loss in the UFC or in WEC technically, was to Chad Mendez, who basically took him down for 3 rounds. Mm-hmm. Jose Aldo's wrestling is not that great. It's not bad, but it's not great. So chances are this is going to be a stand-up fight. So we're going to see basically who is the better striker. And listen, I know Jose Aldo is extremely dangerous. He's got, you know, powerful hands, powerful feet, powerful knees, powerful elbows. All those things are there. But Eric Coke is no joke, man. This is a guy who can stand and trade with the best of them. And he's a big, tall featherweight. Like I said, I really like the dynamic of this matchup. And again, I like the moxie and the makeup of a guy to say, yeah, give me this title shot. I'll take it.
Yeah. I mean, I like it. I like it a lot. And I think that the fans are going to love this matchup, you know, and unless Aldo kind of resorted to clinching a lot, and he might have to in this fight. You know, this is a very compelling fight on the feet for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So let's wait and see how it plays out.
Sometimes these things happen in MMA.
And Jeff, that'll bring us to our next debate topic, and this is the one I have a feeling we're going to talk about quite a bit, is the other side of this equation was Hatsu Hayoki, who was offered the title shot against Jose Aldo. He turned it down. He is now facing Ricardo Lamas at UFC on FX4 in Atlantic City coming up in June. So he passed on the title shot because he says he wants one more fight to get ready. Agree or disagree with the decision to pass on a title shot?
If I'm his management, I don't like it at all. If a fighter feels he's not ready, then I don't want him in the fight. You know, that's one side of me. And the other side of me is, you're the number two fighter in the world. This is what you do. You have to take the title shot. End of it. If I were a promotion, I'd be mad as hell at Hatsu for not taking this fight. But like I said, on the other side, a little bit of me says, look, if you don't feel you're ready, then absolutely don't get in there. So I have mixed feelings on this. But no, at the end of the day, weighing all sides, I don't like turning down title fights when you're the number two ranked fighter in the world.
Yeah. I'll go as far as say I hate this, because the thing is that Hatsu Hayoki is a high level guy. He's fought a lot of high level guys, and I appreciate when Dustin Poirier came out and said, I'm not ready, I want to fight another fight or two before I fight for the title. I appreciate that. I really do, because that's being honest. You know what I mean? That's, you're just being flat out honest and saying, I'm not ready for that title shot and I don't want to blow my chance. But the other side of this is that when you continue to take other fights, title shots are a dime a dozen. I mean, they don't come along very often. Ask Cara Parisian how much he's bummed out that he got an injured sternum and never got to fight for the title.
How long did it take Rashad to get back there?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and that's what I'm saying, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm saying, you never know. These things are not guaranteed. You know, you can say, I mean, it's just like when Dana says, guaranteed title shot to the winner. It doesn't always happen. Ask John Fitch about that. So when you get the opportunity, when they're calling you and saying, hey, do you want to fight for the title at this date with this fight with this opponent? And you say no, who's to say it's ever going to come around the bend again? Because who's to say that, let's say Aldo goes out and fights Eric Coke. Let's say Eric Coke wins, but in the process, he separates his shoulder and he's out for 8 months. Then you're not going to get the next title shot, or you know, all these different myriad of things can happen. Jose Aldo, what happens if Jose Aldo just decides, you know what, I want to go up to 155. I've accomplished all I want to accomplish. I really don't care to fight Poirier or Hayoki. They didn't want to fight me, so screw them. I'm going up to 155. Then maybe you get a title shot, but you're not actually fighting the champion. I mean, there's all kinds of things that can happen that can prevent you from ever actually facing that best guy. And listen, I'm with you, Jeff. I'm torn in the sense of, like, I liked when Dustin Poirier came out and said, very honestly, I'm not ready yet. I'm just not ready yet. I appreciate that. But in someone like Hayoki's case, who's the number two featherweight in the world, what more do you have to do? You're the number two guy in the world. I mean, what are you waiting for? What is there holding you back to say you're not ready? I don't get that mentality. And like I said, I'm not going to feel bad for Hayoki if a title shot never comes his way at this point, because he got offered paper in hand, contract in hand, take this title shot, and he said no.
Yeah, look, it holds up the division. You know, that's – and yes, you know, look, if you don't want to be in the fight, then I don't want you in there. You know, that, I mean, I'm firm on that. But I don't have to like it. You know what I mean? This is the number two ranked guy in the world, and he's turning down a title fight. Then why did you take the contender fights before? Why were you eliminating people from getting title shots when you weren't going to take one? That's what I have a problem with, is he screwed up the entire division by doing that. You know, here he is, number two ranked. Chad Mendes is number three. He just got beat. Poirier's young and says flat out, before he was even considered in a title shot, that I'm not ready for a title shot. I want a couple more fights. I need more experience. Props to him for that, knowing where he is and his place. You know, I think that I'm with you on that. I commend him. And so they go down to number five, and Eric says yes. But Hatsu has screwed up the entire division. He screwed up the entire process of contender fights, because he never intended on fighting Jose Aldo. You know, so that's what I have a problem with it. But on the other side, like I said, if he doesn't want to be in there, then by all means, don't get in there. But don't get in any other damn fights. You know what I mean? Quit eliminating contenders. Go sit on your couch and don't fight, because you're not really a fighter.
Yeah, just like I said, I appreciate the honesty, but again, these title shots don't come around every day. Guys wait, you know, years to get title shots, and then, you know, when they don't get them, they may never get back there again. Again, I bring up the Carl Parisian factor, and there's other guys, too, that just never quite get there. I mean, like I said, it's one of those situations where you believe that with Rashad Evans, I mean, he kind of got lucky in a sense. I mean, he was able to keep winning, but that doesn't always happen. And obviously, if you're a fighter, you know, the mentality, it's the Chuck Liddell mentality from years ago, that when he was waiting for a title shot, just couldn't get it because Tito was doing whatever he was doing. He kept fighting, and he was getting criticized by people saying, you're taking too many risks. And he said, well, if I'm going to end up fighting all these guys anyways, why not do it? That's a different mentality. You know what I mean? That's a different mentality to say, well, if I'm just waiting, I don't want to sit and wait. I want to keep fighting tough guys. And then you keep waiting, fighting tough guys. But to flat out turn down a title shot in favor of sitting out and waiting, it's a really tough spot to be in.
Yeah. I mean, look, the bottom line is, this is how they make their money. You know, you should fight as often as possible, as often as they'll let you and your body will allow you to, because that's how you make money, and your window in this sport is small. And if you're not gunning for a title fight when you're ranked in the top five, then I got to question what the hell you're even doing in the sport. You know, it should be in every sport. Your goal should be the best in the world. Look, 99.999% of us all fall short of that. But Hatsu is right there on the cusp. He can achieve that. And he turned it down. I just you know, to me, it's just baffling. I don't get it at all, Damon. And before, I said he wasn't a fighter. I didn't mean that. But he certainly doesn't have a fighter mentality heading into this matchup, you know, or when presented with the contract to fight Jose Aldo. The guy's a great fighter. Don't get me wrong. That I spoke a little bit, got a little emotional on that. The guy's a fighter. But like I said, I'm not seeing the warrior instinct in him right now.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way around that.
Sometimes these things happen in MMA.
All right, Jeff, with that, we're going to move into our first interview. And he is one of the most famous talk show hosts in all of radio on Sirius XM. His show on there, the Jason Ellis Show, is one of the most popular shows on there. He's also fought MMA. He's trained with the likes of Jason Mayhem Miller, Kit Cope, amongst others. He has a pro MMA fight, and he has a new book out right now called I'm Awesome, One Man's Triumphant Quest to Become the Sweetest Dude Ever. How can you not like that? So we're going to talk to Jason Ellis about his new book and obviously what's going on in the MMA world. And then when we come back, we're going to start our debate topics, talking about the UFC 145 pay-per-view numbers. Also, we have Marlos Kunin coming up on the show and Adam Lin, so stay tuned for that. We are here on MMA Weekly Radio today. I am Damon Martin, and we are joined today by the man, the myth, the legend, the master of awesome himself, Jason Ellis. Jason, thank you so much for taking time for us.
Wow. Thank you. A little bit of an exaggeration there, but I can dig that.
Well, you're awesome. I mean, come on. The book's called I'm Awesome. I got to give you a good intro. Come on.
Yeah, oh, that was great.
So, Jason, the new book is out. I'm Awesome. I had a chance to read it and everything, man. I tell you what, I've read a lot of books, a lot of MMA fighter books, a lot of biographies, man. There's a lot of forthcoming information in there, man. You did not hide anything.
No. Well, you know, that's what happens when you're my radio show is I don't have a filter, and if I'm going to have a book, well, then why would I filter that? So it's weird because it's not really out yet, so friends haven't read it, and my old friends don't really listen to the radio show, so it's probably going to be shocking to a lot of people, but at this point for me, I'm so brutally honest on the radio every day, so this book is really... You know, if you want to, if people who know me want to get weird about it, then go ahead, get weird about it. But yeah, I got to move on.
Well, I got to say, man, I've read, I'm not going to name any names. We both, you know, obviously you've been around the MMA industry. I've read some of the MMA biographies out there, and having covered the sport for the last 8 years, I'm not going to lie to you, man. I've seen some books and I'm like, man, there's some stuff they're not telling us here. They're not being all the way out there, but your book, you are completely out there, man. I don't feel like you're hiding much of anything, if anything. I mean, it's pretty brutally honest.
If there's something that isn't in there, it wasn't because I left it out on purpose. It's probably because I forgot because I had brain damage.
Is that from fighting or skateboarding or what? So what's that from?
It's all of it these days, really. I think, skateboarding got knocked out a lot, and motocross I got knocked out a lot. And now that I'm more of a boxer these days, really, which means it's all directly into the face area most of the time. So I think I might. It might be a bad idea, but I'm getting a little punchy, but, you know, it could be worse. It could be a cigarette smoker, you know?
Yeah. Can you get up in the morning and still remember your name? That's the important part.
I know me.
Okay.
I know who I am.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool. That's right. You're right on then. So now let me ask you, there's a lot of different people in the book, and I want to talk about some of the MMA stuff you've done, of course, since that's what we're doing here on this radio show. But one of the biggest influences I noticed in your book and throughout your life is a guy by the name of Tony Hawk. Now everybody knows who Tony Hawk is, but
Howard Stern.
Well, yeah, except for Howard Stern. But how much of an influence has Tony been on your entire life, I guess is the best way to say it?
Well, you know, I've always... Being a skateboarder, I've always had respect for Tony, but I think later on in my career, I was one of those people that obviously partied a lot and wasn't even really a person that people would think that I would hang out with the Tony Hawk, because he was more of the nerdy kind of skateboarder, and I was sort of hanging out with the cool crowd, which meant that, you know, inevitably we were all going to die or be drug addicts, and those guys were going to be successful businessman, he sort of changed my perspective on the way that everything is and how you go about your career. And it was at the tail end of my career where I made a couple of different changes. I changed things up and tried not to be such a wasteoid, and a lot of it was because of, you know, the influence of Tony Hawk and watching what he's done with his career and how he is with his peers, and just starting to realize that, look, man, you might be good at riding a skateboard, but that's as far as it goes. There's no need to think you're that hot shit, because that's what Tony's like, you know? I mean, he's the most famous skateboarder in the world, but he doesn't give a shit. You know, he doesn't think that you owe him anything because he's Tony Hawk. I definitely have looked up to him in that department, and you know, I work very hard, and he's always been there to help me any way he can. Sometimes... to the point of, it still blows my mind. Like, he wrote a thing for the book.
Yeah.
I didn't even know until it came out. I'm like, dude, you wrote that? He's like, yeah. I'm like, fuck, man, thank you. He just always does that for me. He's a really cool friend.
Yeah, definitely. Let me switch things up to our part of the show, Jason, with the MMA side, because you've actually done professional MMA. Obviously, you mentioned boxing as well. You've trained with Team Quest. Obviously, I know you're really good friends with Jason Mayhem Miller, and that's a book in and of itself, I have a feeling. but for the fans out there, because obviously a lot of fans know you from our show, but at the same time, I mean, what was the... You've been involved in extreme sports, but what was the original interest in MMA? Was it just something you were always a fan of, or did you just like, you know, screw this, I want to try this out, I want to get punched in the face?
Well, I've always, everything I do above and beyond. It's not really, unless of course it's like real work, then I try to get out of it as much as I can. But the skateboarding thing was sort of, it was starting to die off for me. I just couldn't keep up, and I watched like a lot of Pride. I was actually terrified of fighting. I don't like confrontation, and I'm not a fighter. I mean, I used to get in fights at school, but only because I was a smartass. I wasn't trying to fight. People would just beat me up. I think I won one fight my whole childhood, so I wasn't in it for that. I became friends with Kid Cope, and he taught me a little bit on how to kickbox, and I left skateboarding and became a fighter, as in it filled the gap, because I became infatuated with it, and I wanted to learn more, and as soon as I started to learn how to fight, it just reminded me of skateboarding. So I was just, I couldn't learn any more tricks on a skateboard, but I was such a terrible fighter. Well, I got better every day, so it filled the void, and then Ryan Parsons became a really good friend of mine, so then I was training. I had it very easy. I was like training with the team at Quest with Sokaju and all those guys, so it was a very spoiled introduction to the MMA world, and then you train with that team. I think it was within six months I was like, oh, I want to fight. I'm training with these guys, I'm rolling with these guys. I mean, obviously I'm nowhere near their level, but I was like, man, I want a shot at this. So,
yeah. I was supposed to have a guest co-host today. I was going to surprise you because Kit Cope is also a very good friend of mine, but he was training and didn't get back to me. I was going to surprise you and have him on here too. But Kit, I'm calling you out, buddy. You're supposed to be here for this interview, so I'm not letting
him off. He's got a fight pretty soon, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. He does. I messaged him last night and I told him I was interviewing you, and he's like, oh, I got to get on there. I was going to surprise you because I got to be honest, man. Wild World of Spike, still one of my favorite shows, so far ahead of its time. And I got to say, I wish that show would come back. That was an awesome show.
I would do that show again. That was it's funny. Now I would just only enjoy myself the whole time. That was a little bit of stress with logos and sponsors because we were all so fucking broke. It was a bit of a drama, but this time around I'd just be... Because with me and Kit, we're having a great time no matter what. And this time we're getting paid to do stupid shit. It was too good to be true.
The game of Rochambeau, I'll never forget that episode, man. That was the nastiest episode ever. I've tried to get other people to recreate it, but they're not into it, man. I can't get them to do it, so.
That's because you know smart people.
But I love that show, man. It was so far ahead of its time. I wish there was a reunion. We need to get one reunion show, Wild World of Spike, get you and Kit and Sam back together for one-hour special. I think it needs to happen.
They're listening. I'm ready when you are.
Now, you actually, one of my favorite stories from the book, and I don't want to spoil it, I think it's a very short section, but you talked about, in your Vegas days where you're talking about Chuck Liddell giving you a good punch, and you were not going to let him go until he punched you. And you said that was the last thing you remember that night. Tell me that story.
We were doing Tony Hawk's radio show at Kerry Hart's tattoo shop, and I got there at 9 in the morning, and the show wasn't until 4 in the afternoon, so I just started drinking, and before I knew it, I was shit-faced and putting cigarettes out of my arm and talking over everybody and calling Kerry Hart a backflip bitch, which I thought was funny, but no one actually really got what I was talking about. And then Chuck Liddell walked into the tattoo shop, and I'm a massive fan of this guy, and I just was drunk enough to be like, Chucky, how's it going? And I was like, come on, man, punch me. And he was like, I'm not punching this drunk idiot. And then I was like, Kerry, tell him to punch me. Tell him, try to explain to Chucky that I'm a skateboarder, and if he hurts me, I don't give a fuck. And Kerry had enough. He was like, punch this idiot. And then he punched me. I was like, come on, dude, really punch me. And then he punched me again. I was like, come on, dude, don't be a fucking pussy. Do it. And I just saw that look in his eye. And he's like, all right, well, move back. And I was like, move back? So I remember just for a second being a little bit sober right before he punched me. But it was only in the arm. But it was like an overhand right on my arm. And this is a guy that had never trained ever. I did not have a conditioned arm, so
yeah.
When he punched me, I went down, and then I got up, and I was very impressed. I was super stoked to be punched by him because that's what I wanted. Some girl said she was a kickboxer, so I said, I bet you can't make me spill my drink by kicking me in the nuts. So then she proceeded to kick me in the nuts over and over again while I laughed, holding my drink. And what I didn't know at the time was, because I had baggy pants on because I'm a skateboarder. So if you stretch your legs apart, you can kind of cushion the blow with the crotch of your jeans. It's like an old trick. I don't know why I know that. But her toe of her shoe was going in my ass, and I didn't even know. So I went out after that, and then I was at a bar, and I guess Carrie said I dropped a drink out of my hand and was still standing there like I had the drink in my hand. So he said, dude, you got to go to your room, and I went to my room, and oh, that's right, somebody in the tattoo shop, Kerry and some other guy tattooed backflip bitch on my arm because Kerry said, if you call me that again, I'll tattoo you. And I said, good, do it. So I don't remember any of this. All I remember is Chuck Liddell punching me. And then I woke up at 3 in the morning or something, and I got out of bed, and I was like, what the fuck is wrong with my arm? Because Chuck had punched it a couple times by then. And then I took my shirt off, and when I took my shirt off, I realized that I had bitch tattooed on the, underneath my arm. And I'm like, what the fuck do I have? Why do I have bitch tattooed on my arm? And then right then I was like, I feel pain in the hole of my ass. And I was like, I knew how I was when I drank. I mean, I'm not a violent guy, but I'm a fucking smart ass. So I was like, oh my God, I have, this is it. I've said something so offensive that people have held me down, tattooed me, and raped me. So I called Carrie all emotional. He's like, dude, relax. You told some chick to kick you in the nuts like 20 times. Her foot went up your ass. I was like, ah, oh, okay, cool.
But that moment of shock when you first wake up, you're like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah, that was like some of the last times that I was really hammered. Because you know, that was that thing where I was like, okay, it could have been so much worse. I'm not that guy, you know. When I drink a lot, it's just that I become somebody that is inevitably going to get into serious shit.
And with that said, once everything's cleaned up, obviously doing the radio show, which is extremely successful, doing the Ellis Mania shows, which was extremely successful, you close out the book, and not to spoil it for anything for anybody, but you talk about the MMA fighting, and I know you've gone on to do some boxing and everything, but has that been one of the biggest thrills, actually getting in there and competing and doing a real MMA fight? Because let's be honest, Jason, a lot of people talk about it, but not a lot of people actually step in and have the balls to do it.
Right. Well, yeah, for sure it was. I mean, it's the ultimate contest. It's, I mean, being a competitor and really living to compete in skateboarding and anything, really. Like, I don't like being passed on a dirt bike, and I don't like, you know, I don't want to race because I know it's illegal on the street, but if you want to go, I'll go, and that's not really, I don't have a say over it. It's like, it's in my blood to try to win, so. And being so scared of fighting and then to train and then step into the cage with these little gloves on. And really, I mean, I'm not a real fighter. The level that I'm at is not a high level. So it was even scarier. You know, it was a guy that had been training for like 3 years and I think I was 37 at the time. So it was kind of a weird... I remember the athletic commission was like, how old are you? And I said, 37. And the whole table looked at me like, what are you doing? I was like, look, man, I'm not trying to make a career out of it. I'm just doing it for fun. And once again, they all looked at me like, what the fuck are you doing? And I'm like, I don't want to get into it with you. But it was one of the greatest accomplishments ever. I mean, King Mo Lawal and Mayhem and Ryan are in my corner. It was truly a Cinderella story. I was actually going to have it. I actually almost signed a three-fight deal. After that, my wife at the time, who is now my ex-wife, said, no fucking way. She's like, you get one fight. That's what you ask for. That's what you get. You know, which was a great move because, you know, like I said, like you're saying, you've got some MMA guys that their book's not as cool. Well, that's because I'm not an MMA guy. I'm a retired skateboarder on the radio who has issues and steps into the cage and likes to go to the gym and spar people that are way out of my league.
You retire as a 1-0 professional fighter. You can always say that. I was undefeated as an MMA fighter.
I'm not even done. The plan is because I'm going to have I had an amateur boxing fight. I knocked him out in 90 seconds, and then I had the pro MMA fight. So now I can't go back to amateur, so I'm having a pro boxing fight, and then after the pro boxing fight, I'm going to have a pro Muay Thai fight, and then I'm going to retire undefeated in all striking genres.
I like it. So if we send Anderson Silva out to spar with you because you're undefeated, that's probably not a good move, or you would welcome that.
Well, sparring is not that's not like a loss. And yes, I would fight him in a second. I'm not saying because I would win. I'm saying I'm awestruck, and I couldn't think of anything cooler than having the shit kicked out of me by the greatest fighter in the world. I would love that.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned your book, Fedor Emelianenko, as well. Take a punch from him. I mean, there's another career accomplishment. I'm sure that would be something cool. It's like, you know, it's just one of those things.
He kicked me in the leg. He didn't punch me. He gave me a couple leg kicks. He gave me one. I was like, come on, dude, fucking sink it in there. And it was funny because he doesn't speak that much English, but I could tell he was like, oh, okay, shithead, and he sunk one in a little bit, but still, he took it easy.
Did he give you a sweater? Because you know how he has these epic sweaters. I wish I was hoping he would give you a sweater. Have you seen these things?
He just gave me a leg kick, and then him and the Russian mafia left.
That was the end of it. Okay, so
probably a good idea.
Yeah.
I was starting to annoy them. I could tell because I was like, "Come on!" I think I actually because he said no for about half an hour, and then I said something about for the kids. And I somehow tricked him into, like, he should kick me for the kids. How he went for it, but that seemed to be the thing where he's like, oh, okay, for the kids, I will kick you.
That's a weird manipulation, man. I'm not going to lie. I don't know how that one works on Fedor. Maybe that's his weak spot. Like, you know what? I'll do it. For charity, for the kids, I'll give you a swift kick to the legs. I don't know. So.
He seemed like a really wholesome guy. He really did.
Yeah, totally. Well, Jason, we're going to get you out of here, man. We definitely appreciate the time. The new book, it is out. I'm Awesome, One Man's Triumphant Quest to Become the Sweetest Dude Ever. And I got to say, I hope to one day be a pretty sweet dude myself. So thank you for taking the time for us. Good luck on the book tour. And keep kicking ass on the show, man. The show is awesome. Sirius XM.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it.
Definitely. Appreciate the time, Jason. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Later, mate.
Bye-bye. Want to say a big thank you once again to Jason Ellis. Definitely a pleasure to have him on the show. Appreciate him, and make sure you check out his book, I'm Awesome, One Man's Triumphant Quest to Become the Sweetest Dude Ever. That's like the best title ever for a book. I'm serious.
He stole my book title.
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome book title. So we got Marlouz Kunin coming up in just a few minutes. She's headlining this weekend's Invicta FC card in Kansas City, so make sure you check that out. It's free, so make sure you watch that on Saturday. We're going to talk to her in just a few minutes. But our next debate topic, Jeff, we're going to get into some talk about UFC 145 because the reports are out there. Our good friend Dave Meltzer over at the Wrestling Observer has said that UFC 145 pulled in over 700,000 in pay-per-view buys. Does that help solidify John Jones as a real star in the UFC now?
Yes. Yes. And his paychecks just got bigger, you know, because the percentage of that pay-per-view. Yeah, you know, there's not these are big numbers. These are big numbers for the UFC. John Jones, he's the star that we all knew he could be right now, and now he's got the numbers to prove it to Zuffa. You know, because at the end of the day, this is how contracts are negotiated. He brought in 700,000 pay-per-view buys, more than for this. So, the UFC knows now that John Jones is a star, and we know. But you know, but like I said, we kind of saw this coming. You know, John Jones is the future of the sport. He's young and he's at the top of his game, and nobody's even really getting close to this guy. So but now we got the numbers to fall back on to say, see, he is that star.
Yeah. I'm going to put this in a two-part answer. One, yes, he's a star. He's a crossover star. There's no doubt about that. When you look at the amount of people that were talking about John Jones on Saturday night via Twitter, and you're talking about LeBron James, you're talking about The Rock, you're talking about Kaley Cuoco from Big Bang Theory. I mean, all these celebrities, people that, you know, you wouldn't normally look at and say, oh, here's this huge UFC fan. They're tweeting about John Jones. That's a big deal. So he is a crossover star already. I will preface that by saying I think part of the 700,000 pay-per-view buys or in excess of 700,000, whatever it ends up being, part of that does go to Rashad Evans and the rivalry. I mean, that's part of it because you have one of the most heated rivalries in UFC history kind of built up to this fever pitch, and I think a lot of people tuned in because of the rivalry. So what I will say, what I'm warning people about is John Jones' next performance. When he fights Dan Henderson in Calgary, it's a compelling fight, especially to us and especially to the people that watch maybe Dan Henderson's last performance against Shogun in November. But simply said, there's not going to be that same kind of heat or rivalry between those two. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it drop back down in the 600,000, you know, pay-per-view range. But that's still a great number. I mean, that's bigger numbers than anyone else is pulling in right now besides a guy like George St. Pierre or what Brock Lesnar was pulling in. So, yes, he is a bona fide star. Yes, it is a big deal. The only thing I would say just to slow down a little bit is to expect these kind of numbers every single time out. Like I said, Dan Henderson fight will get big numbers. I don't know that it'll excess 700,000 because I think a lot of that 700,000 had to do with the rivalry and the star power of both guys combined. But John Jones is definitely the driving force, if that makes sense.
No, completely. I mean, the rivalry played into it. And plus, there hadn't been a real big fight in a while, you know, honestly. You know, so it had been a while. I mean, yes, there had been pay-per-views and everything, but not a title fight, this caliber of a fight in a long time. And I think that played – the timing sort of played into it a little bit too. But look, I don't expect the numbers to drop off that far, you know, with the Dan Henderson fight. I mean, I could see it dropping to 500,000, but definitely no lower than that. And I could see it staying about the same. I mean, John Jones is a star. We know it. He's got crossover appeal. But yes, I agree with you. There's other variables that played in to that excess of 700,000 pay-per-view bets.
Yeah.
Other than just John Jones.
Yeah, I mean, there's always
he's the biggest part. He's the biggest part.
Yeah, there's always going to be extenuating circumstances. But and also let's not forget, you know, we have lots of time to build up the rivalry between Dan Henderson and John Jones. I mean, you know, just because you know it's not going to get it, listen, it's going to be hard for anything to duplicate what we just saw with Rashad Evans. There was so much buildup. I mean, that was going on for a year. I mean, that's a lot of buildup for any fight. So, I mean, that played a big part in this. But I truly do believe that any fight John Jones is a part of is going to be a big deal now. And I think getting those kind of numbers and increasing just because he's there. Listen, what I would say is I don't think he's quite to GSP level yet, because GSP's a guy who could fight anybody and he's going to pull in a big number because it's GSP. John Jones is on his way there. I think if we see significant numbers for his next fight against Dan Henderson in the 650 to 700,000 pay-per-view range, he is on his way to becoming the next GSP, where it doesn't matter whether John Jones fights Dan Henderson or you and me as a tag team match. People are going to tune in and watch it because John Jones' name attached to it. And ultimately, Jeff, that's what we want. We want a guy who can sell a pay-per-view based on his name alone. While we want these big mega matchups, these huge, you know, these huge stars, these huge fights that everyone wants to see, ultimately what you also want are people that will tune in just because this guy is fighting. And that's what GSP has created. No matter who he fights, no matter when he fights, no matter how he fights, people will tune in to watch George St. Pierre. And I think that's what they're trying to create with John Jones, and he's on his way. I mean, I legitimately believe, I mean, listen, I don't remember seeing all the tweets and messages and celebrities talking about George St. Pierre when he fought last, but I sure as hell saw it on Saturday with John Jones.
Yeah, I mean, I think that look, the UFC needed another star. You know, we've taken some hits. You know, Liddell recently retired. Randy recently retired. Brock Lesnar recently retired. BJ Penn is pretty much retired. You know, we've lost a lot of big-name stars in this sport, and it's refreshing to see another one. We got us another GSP on our hands. I agree with you. He's not quite there yet, but I think that everyone in their right mind knows that he's going to be. And so we have another star, which is huge for the sport because, you know, like I said, we've kind of been retiring more stars than we've been creating lately.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like I said, it's, you know, it's going to take time. I mean, these things don't happen overnight. But I think, you know, seeing John Jones doing what he's done is a big deal. Now, we're going to come up in July and we're going to have such a huge show at UFC 148. I think that's going to pull in big numbers. And that, again, is going to go along with the magnitude of big fights because you got Anderson Silva and Chael Sonnen. And, of course, Uriah Faber. The rivalry card. Exactly.
That's both of those are rivalries.
Yeah, they're going to pull in big numbers. And that's going to be a big deal. But I think when you're looking at singular entities in the sport, you looked for a long time, it was Brock Lesnar and George St. Pierre, and now I think you can start looking at George St. Pierre and John Jones.
I agree.
So I'm all for it. Like I said, we need more stars. John Jones is a star. Welcome to stardom, buddy.
Sometimes these things happen in MMA.
All right, Jeff, we're going to move on to our next interview. She is the headline fight this weekend at Invicta FC, making a return to action for the first time since a loss to Miesha Tate in 2011. We're going to talk to Marlos Kuhn. When we come back, we're actually going to have a debate about another interview that Marlos did yesterday, talking about her former teammate, Alistair Overeem. We also have MFC fighter Adam Lynn coming up later in the show, but right now, here's Marlos Kuhn. It is MMA Weekly Radio, and we are joined today by former Strike Force champion as well as Invicta FC headline fighter Marlos Kuhn. Marlos, thank you so much for taking the time for us today.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm glad to do it. We need PR for Invicta, so no problem at all.
Absolutely. You've been such a big part of women's MMA growth and everything over the years. How exciting was it for you to get the call about an all-women's card like this?
Yeah, that was great, because what I really feel is that Invicta is the next step in the evolution of a sport. You know, we want to become a mainstream sport. Fox News is really good, but if we want to attract also the female audience more, we need to have role models they can relate to. And if you have two girls fighting on a card with for the rest only male, the women will think like, well, they're freaks of nature, and you know, they cannot relate to them. But when you have a full card with different, with a variety of girls, like with Invicta, then a lot of women can relate to it, and the marketing is different. You know, it's not that heavy metal and Harley Davidson look and feel to it. So I think the audience of MMA will grow really big if, you know, Invicta get a good TV deal after this event. So I'm pumped and I'm ready to fight.
Yeah, and I know at the end of the day, the biggest thing for you, Marloes, is getting back in action. You've been out for, at this point, it's going on for several months. I mean, I'm sure you're just itching to get back in there.
Yeah, I know, believe me. And especially because after a loss, you know, you wanna prove to the world that you're still a good fighter. So, yeah, I'm pumped to fight.
Yeah, I know a lot of fighters will tell me after a loss, I mean, they would get back in there 2 days later if they could, just because you want to wash that bad taste out of your mouth. So, How much does it stick with you right now that you're still waiting for that?
No, yesterday I was talking with my time and trainer about, he said, did you watch the fight with Misha Beck? You know, I still haven't done that. You know, because I never thought in a million years I would lose that fight, and I did. And not only I lost it, she made me tap, so it hurt me a lot. And I don't want to take anything away from Misha, because when she fought Ronda Rousey and she didn't tap on that armbar, she really got my respect for not doing that. So, I've got a bad taste in my mouth, and I want to get rid of it.
Yeah, definitely. Now, we know that when you left Strikeforce, everything that happened with that, how exciting was it for you to get that offer and opportunity from Invicta? Because we know that women's MMA, I'm a huge fan, but obviously over time, it's taken the right people to showcase women's MMA. It took Elite XC for a while, then it took Strikeforce. Yeah. How exciting was it for you after you left Strikeforce to get an offer like this from a promotion that is literally built around women's MMA?
Yeah, like I said, to me, it's the evidence that it will be the next step in the evolution of MMA. And knowing that Shannon Knapp is behind it, you know, she's been in the biz for so long, has worked for everything from the UFC to Strikeforce and every IFL, everything before. And I know her very well, and she's very dedicated to what she does. If she does something, she wants to do it good. And that exactly gives me the confidence that Invicta will be lead very well, and it has great opportunities to grow.
Definitely, definitely. Now, to that point, I got to ask you the obvious question. Before we talk about your fight coming up in Invicta, there's a lot of people that are asking about, you know, those potential matchups down the road, getting that rematch with Misha. Maybe you're the person that could dethrone Ronda Rousey. Do those things ever creep into your head, Marloes?
Oh, yeah, of course, and I'm very excited to fight Ronda at a normal weight, 145. But at this point, I'm focusing on my fight, and that's the only thing I'm doing. And, of course, I want to get rid of the bad taste, so if I can face Misha once again, I will certainly do that. But I'm exclusive to Invicta now for fighting in the U.S. Outside, I will be fighting for Glory, of course. But, I don't know what happens. I've got a three-fight deal. And, at the end of my career, I'll be fighting for a few more years. I want to face Cyborg again, and I want to build all the fights prior up to facing Cyborg with good fights, so I'm up for anything.
Yeah. Well, I know one of the biggest things about the whole conversation about Invicta is the opportunity to grow the women's division. That's been an argument that I know Dana White has made over and over again, saying that the divisions just aren't that deep. But, I mean, how important is it for a promotion like this to come along that wants to build that talent up? Because, you know, like you said, only having one women's fight on a card doesn't really give a lot of opportunity. But when you have an entire card filled with women, I mean, that's got to be a great building block for the future of the sport.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know how much Dana knows about the females in MMA, but there are enough girls. There are girls from 115 to over 155. There are enough girls out there with the recognition they get now. Yeah, Ronda did great promotion for their fight with Misha. A lot of girls get interested. More girls who already have a martial arts background will come to the sport. I also see it in the Netherlands. For years, I was the only female MMA fighter. Now more girls are starting to do MMA. And believe me, there are enough girls out there, and even more girls will come. And I think Invicta is a big part of that, because girls will, you know, they can see that we're out there and we're with a lot, you know, and there are good girls out there. And I see that when I warm in the Netherlands, people I don't know, they talk to me, they say, you really inspire me, and, you know, we want to empower women, and, I see a good future for the females in MMA.
Yeah. Well, I know you were one of the people when you were in Strikeforce, Marlous. I remember talking to you back then. You had told me that, you know, there's nothing wrong with a woman being a fighter and also being feminine. That's that common, you know, misconception about women fighters, that you can't be feminine, you can't look like a woman, all those things. And Ronda Rousey, you know, took some heat because she said, yeah, I'm you know, I'm pretty, but I'm also a great fighter. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having both sides of that coin. And Invicta's, you know, giving women a chance to go out there and fight. But again, you were one of the first people that came out and said there's nothing wrong with being a great fighter, there's nothing wrong with being feminine at the same time, so why not, you know, why not accept both roles as a female fighter, right?
Yeah, but I also think that everybody has to decide for themselves how they fit in that role, you know. You can and you also see that, and on the one hand, I think if there's a variety in that as well, that it will only gain to for the growth of the audience. And everybody does it in a different way.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Now, let me talk here, Marlous, about the matchup you have coming up this weekend, because Romy Roussin is a person you faced before early in her career. Let me start with this. I know rematches are sometimes a point of contention with fighters. You know, when you've beaten somebody, they don't necessarily want to face them again. They don't get as inspired for that kind of fight. When you heard the name, did it matter to you who you faced? Or?
No. Not at all. In the past, I've been fighting when I was fighting in Japan a lot. I often had to fight a girl several times. I did it with Megumi Fuji and Ishibara and Yuki Kondo. And in my opinion, if you're a fighter, you have to accept any fight. And I will offer them fights until they don't want to fight me anymore, you know. And I think that if you're a true fighter, you will do that.
Yeah. So how much do you think, you know, because, I mean, again, I mentioned you fought her early in her career. How much do you believe she's progressed and changed since the first time you fought her?
I think a lot. I saw her fighting in the Netherlands after my fight a few years later. She's on a 4 win streak with fights ending within 1 minute in the first round. And she was young, so you progress a lot. So no, she's a very dangerous opponent, but totally do not underestimate her.
Yeah. Is there also a certain level of danger attached to a person that you have beaten? You know, people look at the record and say, well, we already beat her. And also because, Marlous, let's be honest, you're one of the top female fighters in the world, so that comes along with a certain pressure. So do you always have to be careful of facing somebody that, I don't want to say she has nothing to lose, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's an easy fight for her, and it's a more difficult fight for me. That's true, but you know, there's so many things that you can take as an excuse to have a tough fight. You know, and I'm jet lagged. Oh, I gotta make weight. You're a fighter in the end of the day, so it doesn't matter how you get into the ring, how much pressure you have. You just have to show up and kick ass.
Yeah, and you seem to be a fighter that reacts very well coming off a loss. You know, when you had the loss to Cyborg, you came back and submitted Sarah Kaufman. Coming off the loss to Misha Tate, is there a certain statement you want to make in this fight to not only say I'm back, but I'm as good as I've ever been?
Yeah, well, what do you think? Oh, my God, you have no idea. Believe me.
So the fans watching Invicta will be very, very happy to see your performance.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, you know, I'm really grateful to the American people, because when I came into Strikeforce, I was kind of afraid that they would boo me, and I was fully, you know, prepared for that. And then the American audience really embraced me, and I was almost astonished by it. And I've been in Kansas for a few months, and the people are so nice, you know, and I'm fighting now in Kansas. So to me, it all adds up. And I always say, like, I love a submission, but I prefer a KO.
Yeah.
And I hope I can deliver that.
Yeah. Well, this seems like such a great format for women's MMA, and Marlous, we're really looking forward to seeing you back in action, and I want to give you a chance before I get you out of here, be it the teammates you have, your sponsors, people supporting you. Is there anybody you wanted to give a shout-out to today?
You know, of course, my manager, Buzz Bone, and Fight Game, Hayabusa, and you, thank you for the time, and if people want to follow me on Twitter, please do so. Oh, and watch the fight on Invicta FC on my website for free.
Definitely, definitely. Well, Marlous, again, best of luck coming up this weekend. We really appreciate the time, and we look forward to seeing you back in action.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Want to say a big thank you once again to Marluz Kuna. Make sure you check out her fight this weekend. Invicta FC Saturday night free online. Jeff, we're going to move into our next debate topic and on another interview, and I kind of feel bad I didn't ask this question, but Marluz Kunin obviously took her former teammate from Golden Glory, Alistair Overeem, to task for some of the things he said about the team and the management since he left there. And obviously the whole lawsuit, and we've seen everything that's come out with him and Golden Glory. And she pretty much took him to task for everything he said. So let me ask you this. Here's the debate topic. Who's more to blame in this situation, Overeem or Golden Glory?
You know, it's hard to say, really. But at the end of the day, Golden Glory was no longer representing Overeem the way he needed to be. And so he had to leave. You know, but I agree with a lot of what Marlo said. You know, you can leave a camp and part ways because they had been together so long is why I say this. So the relationship wasn't bad until recently. And so he threw out everything that had good that had happened at Golden Glory and kind of throws these comments out now. And Marlo gets wrapped up into that and it brings the camp down. You know what I mean? So Overeem could have left and went on his way without doing it the way that he did. So I kind of agree with her there. But look, at the end of the day, if your management isn't representing you the way you need to be to get these big fights in the UFC, then you have no choice but to leave. So I blame Golden Glory for the situation with Overeem, but I don't like the way Overeem handled it, if that makes sense.
There's something to be said for loyalty in this sport. You know what I mean? It's a rare thing. Let's be honest. Loyalty is not a big deal because at the end of the day, we're all here to get a paycheck. We're all here to become better people, whatever, whether it's me becoming the better writer or a radio show host to a fighter trying to become champion. We're all trying to get a paycheck and be happy with ourselves at the end of the day. Whatever that results in, that's what it results in. And loyalty is a tough thing, Jeff. You and I both know that. Loyalty is a very, very tough thing in this industry. And I think the way it's being perceived, the way Alistair handled everything was he wasn't showing very much loyalty to people that showed him a lot of loyalty for a lot of years. And that's my only problem with this. I'm not saying that Alistair – here's what I'll say. I'm not saying that Alistair didn't have legit complaints because I'm sure he did. I'm sure he had legit complaints. But here's the problem is he stuck by Golden Glory for more than a decade. And some of the stuff that Marluz brought up, you know, for some of the stuff they did for him, that's where you talk about the loyalty factor. You know, when you talk about you know, things they did for him to keep him out of trouble, things they did to keep him in fights, all these different things. When he was down and out, they stood by him, all these different things. And that's where loyalty comes in. So I'm not saying that Golden Glory wasn't at fault. I'm not saying, obviously, if at the end of the day, it's proven fact that they stole money and all those things, then obviously you got to jump ship. But the problem is the public perception by what she's saying is that he did, you know, they stuck by him during the darkest days. And then as soon as he got a chance to jump ship and become famous and, you know, get a bunch of money from the UFC, he was gone. And that, I think, is where the problem comes from. You know what I mean? I think that's where the issue kind of points back at Overeem being the bigger issue. I mean, I know Boss Rutan has had comments about this as well, that he kind of took Overeem to task when he left Golden Glory. And Boss Rutan is a person I have the utmost respect for in this industry. I'm not saying that he's not infallible because I don't think anyone's infallible, but Boss Rutan is pretty damn smart. He knows what he's talking about and he knows a lot of players in the industry. So again, I'm not trying to toss Overeem under the bus here, but I got to look at the situation. Listen, if it's ultimately proven that Golden Glory really was stealing money from him, then yeah, you got to get rid of those guys. There's no way around it. But just looking at it from the outsider's view, looking at what Marluz has said, looking at what else has come out in the press, guys like Boss Rutan, I got to put a little bit more of the onus on Overeem here, at least for the way he handled it. I mean, there's a way to leave without making it so public and making it so nasty. And it seemed like things just turned nasty in like a split second.
Absolutely. You know, and that's my deal. Look, I'm with you. Overeem had legitimate gripes, and if everything that if half the stuff that is alleged is true, he should have left. You know, but look, Damon, I left MMA Weekly. I didn't throw anybody under the bus whenever I did that. You know what I mean? You have a certain loyalty. You've worked with these people forever. They've been in your corner. You've been in the trenches with them. And so whenever you walk, you just walk. You don't handle it the way that Overeem handled it. Now, I do want to say that Marluz is a different situation. Marluz got caught up in all this. You know, she very well could have lost her job in Strikeforce because of Golden Glory's negotiations with Zuffa. You know what I mean? She got caught up in you know, kind of a collateral damage in all of this. And certainly she doesn't like the way Overeem handled things. But she's not Golden Glory. You know, the situation between Overeem and Golden Glory, that's an ugly situation on both sides. I think Overeem shouldn't have handled it the way that he did. And I think I completely understand where Marluz feels the way that she feels and sides with the team.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's a nasty business, and it's one of those things. I think the reason why this got so ugly with these guys is because Overeem was with Golden Glory for so long. You know, if he was with Golden Glory for 6 months and they split, we probably wouldn't care two squats about it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because it was just but he was with them for over a decade, and it was kind of like synonymous. It would be like, you know, for me, I mean, not to say this is ever going to happen, but it would be like Nick Diaz leaving Cesar Gracie. I mean, yeah. We would all be like, what? You know, like, what in the world's going on here? Because they've been such a tight-knit group for so long that everyone would be a little shook up, you know, if he was not there with him. You know, saying, you know, like I said, there's certain people that are just affiliated. I mean, when Koscheck left AKA, that sent a lot of, you know, shockwaves, and he was talking very honestly in the interview I did with him about Javier Mendez and things. It sent a lot of shockwaves because he had been a mainstay of that team for years. I mean, it wasn't like he was there for 6 months. He'd been there for like 7 years. So yeah. When that happens, you know, I remember when Diego Sanchez left Jackson's, that was a big deal because he
Or Rashad. I mean, hell, we're still talking about that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a big deal when these things happen. Like I said, when it's that big of a, when it's that big of a split that you've been with somebody for so long. And I think that's part of the problem with the whole Overeem thing is because he had been with them for so long.
Yeah. I mean, that's my deal, is there should have been a little more loyalty and more professionalism in the way that he exited. You know, but the problem with being at a place, and you know this as well as I do, Damon, is things get personal. You know, little things all of a sudden are personal to you when really they're just part of the business. And so, you know, I understand where Overeem and Golden Glory really, really are at odds over this, you know, and it feels personal. But Overeem handled it wrong. I mean, you can't get around that. Overeem handled it wrong. He shouldn't have thrown everybody under the bus. There was a lot of people over there that didn't have anything to do with his situation with Golden Glory, who got caught up in it and got insulted by his comments. You know, so he should have seen the bigger picture. He got back at Golden Glory when he left them and sued them. You know what I mean? He didn't have to throw the whole team under the bus and everyone associated with it.
Yeah, I agree.
Sometimes these things happen in MMA.
All right, Jeff, we're going to get to our last interview of the day before we come back with our last debate topic of the day. Adam Lin is a 34-year-old fighter who has been around the sport for many, many years, took a couple years off, and then decided to come back. He is now fighting in Maximum Fighting Championships. He had the knockout of the year last year and a win over Curtis DeMars. He's coming back this week, next week, at MFC. It also broadcasts live on HDNet, so make sure you check that out. But let's talk to Adam Lin. When we come back, we're going to talk about our final debate topic of the day, and it's Anheuser-Busch is having issues with some of the stuff that's been going on with the social networking and things that have been going on being said by guys like Miguel Torres, Rashad Evans, and others. We're going to talk about that when we come back, but right now here's Adam Lin. It's MMA Weekly Radio. I am Damon Martin. We are joined today by Maximum Fighting Championships lightweight Adam Lin. Adam, how is everything?
Hey, what's up, people? Everything's good, man. Training's good. Training's underway and ready to do this.
Obviously, fight is just around the corner, man. You've been on quite a run lately. I got to ask you, I mean, obviously, you've been around the sport for a long time, but I got to ask you the honest question, Adam. What do you feel like has been the biggest part of your success lately?
You know, to tell you the truth, it's just the people around me. You know, I've been around. I pay my dues. I've had my ups and downs, and I've been on the other side of the coin, too. So, you know, I attribute it to I know what it feels like to lose. You know, so you got to know what it's like to lose if you want to know what it's like to win. So, I mean, I put a lot of, that attests for a lot of it.
I know you had taken some time off a couple of years ago, and if I remember correctly, reading in interviews and hearing interviews with you, you were getting your school together, just taking some time off to kind of get things organized, those kind of things, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so you take the time off, you come back in 2010, and you've been on this incredible run right now. Do you feel like this really is the, you know, kind of the stars aligning for the right time, the right place, everything's working out right now? Because you're a veteran, you've been around, but you and I both know, you know, obviously there's ups and downs in this sport, but it seems like right now you've been on a really incredible run.
Yeah, you know, you're right. Yeah, everything you said is correct, and like I said, you know, I train with a lot of people, kind of around the West Coast and stuff, and it really, like, when I came back home and just started working with my best friends and just people that are close to me and helping my students and everything, that seems to be my recipe right now. You know, I don't want to mess with it too much. You know, it's like I said, it's working, and I've been on the other side of it, so, you know, I like this much better. That and my motivation, you know, it's I think in the past, it's easy to, you know, it's easy to stay in shape and it's easy to, you know, book these fights and stuff like that. But you got to keep your motivation and your spirit aligned with it. And that's, you know, I've just been noticing, like, when I lose track of that and when I have to get back on track with it. So, you know, just trying to keep everything lined up.
And I know, again, from reading in past interviews that your real passion is being a teacher and being an instructor. You love that part of your life. Was there ever a part after getting your school up and running and taking time away, was there ever a part of you that, didn't think about coming back, or did you always know you would?
No, I mean, when I originally stopped in 2007, like, I stopped. The only reason that I started fighting again, well, two reasons was, you know, I was trying to train a bunch of amateurs, and it's I want to get them to a level that I was never at, and me being me and just the way that I know how to coach, like, I can only try to do the best of my ability. So it's hard for me to try to coach these guys to get to a level that I've never competed at. And I stopped for a while, and like I said, I had to pay the rent, dude. You know, like, I was done fighting. I wanted to teach, and I still want to teach, but, I mean, right now it's tough, dude. Teaching's not paying the bills, so, I mean, I got to do what I got to do to pay my rent.
Yeah, but that, you know, doing what you got to do has turned out very well for you because you've been on an incredible run lately, and obviously a big fight coming up at the next MFC show. It seems like whatever is working together, man, call it magic, call it, call it the right ingredients. It seems like whatever you're doing, it's working.
Yeah, but you know what, like, it's good and it's successful right now, but the trick is not to get sucked up too much into it. You know, when I started fighting again, it wasn't anything serious. I just wanted to, I still had some juice left in me. I wanted to compete, and I'm happy that I'm winning, but, you know, I'm not trying to be anything that I'm not, you know what I'm saying? I don't want to get sucked back up into the game. I really enjoy my life right now, and, so as long as I enjoy doing the sport, I think I'll be successful at it.
Yeah, definitely. So now let's talk about, you know, obviously your last fight out, man, you had the elbow knockout of the year at the MFC. You come back. Now, I had a conversation not long ago with Michael Chandler, and I'm sure you're aware of Michael, you know, Bellator champion. You know, coming off such a phenomenal win over Eddie Alvarez, it's almost one of those career-defining moments. When you come off a big knockout or a big moment in your career, that next moment, that next fight, sometimes can be an emotional letdown. So you had such a big knockout, such a big way to kind of close out 2011. How do you make sure that 2012 kicks out the right way?
Man, you're right. You know, like I said, I mean, some guys can get sucked into that, but it was a hell. I've been thinking about doing that elbow to somebody since I was 16. To be honest,
I love it.
You know, but it's not an emotional letdown for me. I can't complain, dude. You know, I get to do what I love to do. I get to fight on TV. Like, I already won. You know what I'm saying? It's. I don't care. I don't care if I go in there, fight three rounds and lose, fight three rounds and win. I don't care. I'm still doing what I love to do. You know, so I don't approach it like that.
Yeah, exactly. So with this fight, when you take on a guy like Mukai Muromo, who is the African assassin, very dangerous guy. I want to ask you, because I get this from a lot of different fighters. When you look at your opponent, are you a guy that studies your opponent and says, okay, I want to see what he does, I want to look at his fight clips, those kind of things? Or do you approach the fight and just focus more on yourself and say, he's got to deal with me?
To be honest with you, my coaches will look at the fight. I don't look at it too much, you know. But my coaches will look at it and they'll tell me what they want me to do. But my approach is, yeah, similar to what you said. Like, I think that I found something that works for me, and I just try to get better at that. You know, I think it's his job to bring it to me, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And it seems like, you know, like I said, is there, because again, you've got that experience. You said you're not focused on, you know, if you go in there and fight a three-round fight and lose or whatever, but when you're on a certain run, you get a certain confidence build up, you just have a certain momentum behind you. Does that help? As I mentioned, the run you're on right now has been a great run. Does that help at all, or can it actually serve as a distraction?
Oh, no, 100%. Yeah, it helps. You know, it can help and hinder. You know, it depends on the person. If you let that pressure get to you, like, oh, you know, I want to try to keep this going. I mean, you're basically going to end up fighting yourself. You know, you're in your head, you know. But I don't know. It's a lot of motivation on my part. I've never been able to do this in my career. You know, it's always been win a couple, drop one, win a couple, drop one. So it's more motivating. You know, I'm 34, so I can kind of see the finish line, you know, so I do it for a couple more years, you know what I'm saying? So, like, it's just more, I want to get as much as I can out of it. So, you know, that brings me to the gym every day.
Yeah, definitely. And this is a great fight. I know MFC is a really solid organization out of Canada. I know you've only had one fight with them, but how was your experience working with those guys?
Yeah, you know, I like it. I have a couple friends that, you know, I was training with Antonio McKee and Diego Bautista and stuff, both MFC fighters. So, I mean, I have relationships with people that have been involved with them for a while. Yeah, I thought, you know, it's pretty no-nonsense. They fly us up there and they take care of us and, yeah, man, do the damn thing. So,
Exactly. Well, Adam, I tell you what, man, this is a great fight. Looking forward to seeing you back in action. And I want to give you a chance before I get you out of here, be it teammates, sponsors, anybody out there you want to give a shout-out to. It is your time, my friend. You go right ahead.
Wow. First and foremost, you know, I want to thank my training partners and my gym, Subfighter MMA in Laguna Hills. I want to thank Fighting Uncle for their support. Madam Sunglasses, Young and Reckless, and OG Abel. And then I think that's it, man. Thanks for all the support, guys.
Absolutely. Well, again, Adam, best of luck coming up in the fight. We definitely appreciate the time, and safe travels and have fun in Canada.
Thank you so much, David.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye. Want to say a big thank you again to Adam Lynn. Make sure you check out his fight next Friday night, MFC on HDNet. And Jeff, we have one final debate topic to get to. And in Ad Age magazine, Anheuser-Busch, who is obviously the owners of Bud Light, have taken offense to some of the comments that have been made by UFC fighters on social media networks and in interviews and things like that. In return, the UFC is now going to mandate sensitivity training and some other seminars to prevent some of these things from happening social media-wise. Big deal or not a big deal?
I think it's a big deal. I think it's a really big deal. I mean, the biggest sponsor the UFC has, or at least a major one that they have, is basically pissed off at them about fighters, the way fighters are conducting themselves on social networking. We talked about this whenever, you know, with the Miguel Torres case and the Forrest Griffin case about the rape comments and Miguel being fired over them. You know, we thought that they should have already had this sensitivity training whenever they came in because they do the fighter summits. You know, the UFC had this common sense policy. Well, apparently that doesn't work. But I think this is a huge deal because Anheuser-Busch is ridiculously big, and the UFC doesn't want to lose that type of sponsorship. And when we're talking about this type of level, we've got the UFC to this point. Anheuser-Busch is a huge part of it. So I think this is a big deal. You know, I think we got off lucky in a way. Anheuser-Busch throws the weight around. You know, they throw out $1.3 billion in sponsorships to sports every year. And, yeah, you know, they probably could care less if the UFC's on board or not. You know, they got Major League Baseball. They got NASCAR. They got you know, tons. The NFL. I mean, you know, we're really not their biggest player, not their biggest client. And so we really have to play ball, Damon. And these fighters really need to become more aware that they're public figures. You know, we've been running this sport like it's just a small community. Well, we built it bigger than that, but we're still conducting ourselves like we're this small community.
Yeah, it's a really big deal because when you start, you know, being threatened to lose sponsors over things like social networking and things like, it's one thing to lose sponsors because the money's not there and you're not getting a return on your investment. It's another thing when it's something like the fighters, the people, the product are turning you off to it, and that's where you got to be. That's a walk in a dangerous line right there. I've said for a long time, Jeff, that I'm glad MMA is not football and basketball, where everything you say is not microanalyzed. I mean, when a guy in football says I guarantee victory, people rip them to shreds. Left and right saying, oh my God, he guaranteed victory. He's putting a bounty on their heads. And oh my God, it's great. It's the worst thing ever. I don't want to get to the point where we overreact like the media does in other sports where they freak out when everything says. I don't want Roger Goodell's boring, growing green ass to be the president of my sport that I cover, which is mixed martial arts. I appreciate Dana White's candor and honesty and the way he put things out there and says things. And it's not just because it's a soundbite and it's not just because I like writing about it. It's because it's interesting. Because, listen, like I said, I've watched Roger Goodell and David Stern and these other people out there, and oh my God, it's like, seriously, like, you know, just stab me somewhere so I know I'm alive still. So I don't want that. But there is a line. And the line that gets crossed is when you go on Twitter and start making rape jokes, when you go in press conferences and start saying you're gonna touch people worse than the kids at Penn State. I mean, that's where you cross the line, and that's where I say that, you know, when you talk about the sensitivity training, you talk about the mandated programs, things like that, my issue would be is that's great, but then same thing I said months ago, Jeff, is there's got to be some sort of plan in place that if people still do it, that they get punished, be it released, be it suspended, be it fined, whatever it is, there's got to be something public. And I know it's going to sound like BS to a lot of people. Maybe it is BS, because maybe they're going to, you know, it's like when I hear about a fine of an NFL player for a bad hit, I'm thinking to myself, he's not paying that. The organization's going to pay it for him. You know what I mean? Like, they're going to be like, okay, buddy, you're a great team. We're going to pay it for you. We're going to give you a bonus and pay that fine. But you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying I have facts or proof to back this up. I have this gut feeling that a lot of these guys that get penalized in the NFL for stupid things, they're probably not actually paying their own penalties. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm completely off base, but I just get that feeling in my gut. And so maybe it's just a public, you know, it's just a public stance. It's like, you know, Ron Artest was just suspended for 7 games for elbowing that player in the head the other day. And it's, you got to make a public statement when things like this happen. When Miguel Torres got fired, that was a big public statement. What was not a big public statement was rehiring him a week and a half later. And that's what I'm talking about. If you're going to make a public statement, make that. You know what I mean? The next person that does it, you crack him, and you crack him good. You fine him $25,000 and you suspend him from their next fight. Watch him. Watch and see how quickly people don't go on Twitter and say stupid stuff. The same thing I said yesterday. Excuse me, with the whole performance-enhancing drugs, I had a lot of people that said, you know, when I said 18-month suspension for a first offense and 3 years for a second offense, a lot of people were saying that's great. Other people were saying that's crazy. You're effectively ending a guy's career when you do 3 years. And I said, good, because who is going to cheat? Who is going to take that chance? Who's going to go to GNC and say, give me whatever you want. What's on sale? Give it to me. Who's not going to investigate a little bit more if it could literally cost them their career? And it's the same thing with this. Who is going to go on there and make rape jokes and bad, really, really distasteful jokes? And like I said, there's a line. I mean, like I said, I don't want us to be so PC that we can't say anything without being microanalyzed and all these things. But at the same time, you know, rape jokes and things like that, man, there's no room for that. If you're a professional athlete and you're a representation of an organization, so there needs to be a punishment or a penalty attached to that. And that would be my next level. The sensitivity, the social networking, all those seminars, that's great. But there's got to be a penalty attached to it that if you do it, you know you're going to get cracked and cracked good. And I guarantee at that point, people won't be so apt to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if the Anheuser-Busch, you know, has, they've warned the UFC. I think the UFC, the next time we see it, they're going to come down harsh, because you know what? Losing one fighter, and I don't care who it is. I'll put it that way. I don't care how big of the star it is. It firing them over not losing Anheuser-Busch makes perfect sense. But look, this is the business of Major League Sports, or you know, professional sports. They live and die by sponsorships, and you really have to appease the sponsors. And look, Anheuser-Busch is right. You know, these fighters shouldn't be on there saying that crap. They represent the company and indirectly represent Anheuser-Busch, and they're making rape jokes. You would think that Dana White's common sense approach would work, because that's common sense to me. You know, you can't make comments about rape, child abuse, really violence at all, considering the sport that we're in, race, religion, you know, or ethnicity or sexual preference. You cannot do it. That's common sense in any public forum. It's a shame that we have to go this far, honestly, but it needs to be done, apparently. You know, but Anheuser-Busch giving a warning is a very big deal, a very big deal. Anheuser-Busch throws their weight around. They sued Major League Baseball, over a sponsorship deal and won. Well, they got the settlement that they wanted, put it that way. So Anheuser-Busch, when they throw their weight around, people need to take a step back and listen. And I think Dana White will do that now. I think Zuffa will do that. And these fighters are absolutely going to get cracked with it, and they're not going to get brought back like Miguel Torres.
Yeah, and that's ultimately what I'm talking about. Is, like I said, if there's a punishment that goes along with it, then I think it happens. You know what I mean? Like I said, if your crackdown right now is going to say sensitivity training and that kind of stuff, that's great. That's a good step. But ultimately, if it's going to result in penalties, if somebody goes on Twitter and says something really stupid, and like I said, I don't want it to be so PC that you can't make a stupid remark or an off-color joke, you know what I mean? Because like I said, but I also don't get offended easily, you know what I mean? Like, I don't get offended by anything, you know, like that. I just don't get offended, but other people do. And I'm not saying I want MMA to become so PC that we can't have guys speak in their minds. There's a way to speak your mind. I mean, there's guys who call each other out on Twitter, and they call each other every name in the book, and I don't see anything wrong with that. And that, I want, you know, that I have no problem with that continuing. What you have to, you know, there are like that, it's like the seven dirty words you're not allowed to say on TV or whatever. It's kind of like that. There's certain subjects like race, like race, rape, things like that. You just don't bring up. You know what I mean? Like, there's just some things you just don't bring. I mean, I don't have a problem if people talk about politics. I mean, that's
not in a joking light. Yeah, I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, if you're gonna tweet about rape, tweet that you're helping out a rape victims, clinic or whatever. You can't. I mean, you know, we can touch the topic, but not the way the damn fighters are doing it. They're cracking jokes about it. Yeah. And look, I'm with you, Damon. I don't get offended by anything. When I see those remarks, I'm not offended by them. But what goes through my head is, oh shit, this is going to cause a storm, you know?
Yeah.
And so the fighters should be thinking that the same thing. They should be thinking the same thing.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what it all comes down to, man. They gotta be aware of that. So this is a big deal, and
Who's our biggest sponsor? I mean, MMA Weekly's biggest sponsor. If they called us and said, "Jeff, you've said a cuss word on the radio show," guess what? I'm not saying that again.
Yeah.
You know, and people need to keep that in. This is a huge deal, man. This is a huge deal.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, they gotta pay attention to it. And obviously, I think they are. So
sometimes these things happen in MMA.
All right, with that, Jeff, we're going to get out of here. Obviously, end of the week, we want to say all the thank you to all of our guests that we've had on this week, of course, and a big thank you today to Marlus Kuhn and Jason Ellis and Adam Lynn. We definitely appreciate all them coming on, and we'll be back next week. We're going to start geared up with the UFC on Fox 3. That card's coming up right around the corner next Saturday night, man. It's creeping up.
It's crazy. Tons already. Of MMA coming up, though. Tons of MMA.
Yeah, already here, man. UFC on Fox 3, and then right after that, we go into UFC on Fuel, and then UFC 146. So it's like I said, it keeps rolling, man. Never slows down, really.
No. And then you mix in some Bellator and a Strikeforce in there, and we're busy people.
Yeah, it never really slows down in this business. So, yeah, we'll have lots and lots of stuff going on next week with UFC on Fox 3 and all kinds of other stuff. So, again, want to say a big thank you to Marlus Kuhnen, to Jason Ellis, and to Adam Lynn. We definitely appreciate that. And for Jeff Kane, I am Damon Martin. We will see you guys on Monday. Have a great weekend, and we will see you then.